Hello, listeners. Welcome to another new edition of Show Me State of Mind podcast. We are excited to have you here. It's our little project to kind of record all the cool stuff that's happened in Missouri mental health landscape over the past decade or so. And so, really glad you've joined us. Welcome. Well, welcome to our podcast. We are so excited about today's show for you, listener. We are really excited to welcome our special guest today. This is someone who has been in the field just a little while. If I'm not mistaken, she started out as a substance abuse counselor, moved into adult psychologist, crisis coordinator, director of community care, Director of Family Preservation Services, Director of New Directions, Director of Crisis Services. And now, since 2017, she has been the Chief Administrative Officer of Ozark Center, which is affiliated with Freeman Health and is also kind of down in my hometown. So I'm very proud of that. This is the one and only Vicki Meisler. Welcome, Vicki.
Thanks, Brent. I'm really excited to be on my first podcast ever.
Well, yeah, that's right. We'll try to make it not very painful for you. Just informal and a lot of fun. And you've got a lot of things that we want to tickle out of your brain today. So I appreciate the time. I really do.
My pleasure.
Great, great. Well, again, thanks for your service to Ozark Center from that long list of things that you've done for the community and for Ozark Center in Southwest Missouri, and including my hometown of Neosho. So again, a shout to Southwest Mo, but also I really want to thank you for your leadership to mental health larger than that in Missouri, and really almost if you think about it, nationally. And we're going to get into that a little later because I always say this, but Ozark Center has been one of those agencies with you and your team in particular leading the way that has modeled a lot of really amazing, innovative things that we then have replicated and modeled in Missouri, and then kind of built upon those things, honestly, around things that have become a really part of the national CCBHC model. But we'll get into that later. But I really want to kind of start, if that's okay, Vicki. You and I have spent a lot of time together, and in fact, probably first got to know each other through the tragedy down in Joplin back on May 22nd, 2011. And for those of you that are younger and listening and may maybe weren't quite around or didn't quite know how impactful and significant that tragedy was for Joplin's that Joplin community. I really wondered, Vicki, if we might want to record that a little bit on this podcast and dig into that a little bit. And if you don't mind starting, kind of where were you, or how did that night, that Sunday evening unfold for you personally?
So May 22nd, 2011, Brett, is like a significant day in the history of all the residents of Joplin, Missouri. I think everyone's affected in many, many ways. But on that Sunday afternoon, I was home alone, enjoying what I would typically do on a Sunday afternoon. If it wasn't a sports season, I would be watching Lifetime movies on TV and enjoying the fact that I was home alone. So my husband was at work, my two kids were at work, and we started the day with a beautiful Sunday afternoon. Not expecting a whole lot of activity, but started hearing some chatter about the possibility of some severe weather. But here in Southwest Missouri, most of us
Yeah.
don't really
That's not uncommon at all, is
No. Well,
it?
you'd often see possibly inside the house the mother is getting the kids kind of corralled, but the dads are all outside checking out the sky, looking to see if they can see anything. So we didn't get too excited about it, but very, very quickly things changed. And we have my husband built an underground shelter in our garage. So myself and the
Wow.
dog are headed to the underground shelter, and I was listening to the radio, and actually the tornado, one of the tornadoes, because it was a combined tornado that really created the severe damage that Joplin had. But one of the tornadoes was expected to head directly to Carl Junction, which is where I live. So I was taking shelter with the dog. My daughter, who was at Freeman Health System working, called me, and I had very difficult time hearing her. The connection was really poor. But I remember saying, don't leave, because I had just heard someone yell on the radio, it's headed to Joplin, it's headed to Joplin. And that's when the tornadoes, there were two kind of side by side, and that's when they crossed and joined together and made the full rain curtain, which is the most deadly type of tornado. And before I could get, all those words out, she and I lost connection. So I was worried, where is she? Tried to call her again, didn't get through. Weathered out the time of the few minutes that a tornado comes your way. This one actually was a 22-minute tornado on the ground, which is very rare. Very,
Unbelievable.
very rare. So then I'm, panicking. They're saying Joplin's destroyed. I'm trying to get there to not only, you wear a lot of hats when you work. So you're
Yeah, right.
professional, you're a mom, you're a wife, you're trying to, you're a daughter, a sister, you're trying to account for your family members, but you're also trying to figure out, what you have left of your business. So
Yeah,
I'm
you have residential programs, you have, it's so many hats.
Yeah. So on my way into Joplin, I tried to figure out the route she would have left Freeman, because she would have driven right into the heart of that tornado had she left work, because she was calling to tell me, I'm leaving work, I'm headed home. So I, drove the path I thought I could maybe find her or find her car. So I looked for a lot of cars. The significant thing about the tornado is there were thousands and thousands and thousands of wrecked cars everywhere, piled on top of each other, and a lot of lives were lost. And so it's not a recommended thing to be looking through cars, but it took me hours and hours to find her. But when I did, it was like one of those moments, in like a romance movie where you're like slowly running toward each
Oh,
other,
God.
and hugging. And I just remember her whispering in my ear, I've seen dead bodies. I said, I know. Let's just get in my car, and you're going to be my assistant, because now I got to work. Because I had gotten a
Stay
text
with me.
from the CEO at the time, Phil Wilcoxon, who was in California. You're in charge till I can get there. So I had to assume the role and go look for what was left of our business. So we lost four facilities. Four large facilities were just completely destroyed. And that was our autism center, which had just opened the year before
Just
in 2010.
brand new. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, oh, we lost our kids' outpatient facility. We lost our detox and residential substance use facility that had 20, 25 people staying in it. And then we lost our business center. And then we had four facilities that were severely damaged and unusable. And those happened to be around our apartment living clients. So our HUD apartments were not usable. So then you've got, 36 to 40 people who are homeless, and you're responsible for them. And so one of the
Oh
very
my
first
goodness.
things we had to do was figure out where these patients could go quickly. And then, there are other damages, to other buildings across the city. It went right through the center of Joplin and just tore a path of major destruction. But I think like one of the most memorable moments I had was setting up our command center downtown, which happened to be across the street from the police department and the city utilities, and going outside and answering yet another call because my phone was ringing off the wall when I was in that location. Otherwise, it didn't work.
There was
But
no communication. Yeah, right.
we couldn't use our cell phones very often. But down there, I had access and I'd gotten a call. I'd gone outside and I saw Keith Schaefer, who at that time was the director of the Department of Mental Health, and Todd Scheibel, who was the CEO of Beryl, walking up the sidewalk in their suits. And my first thought was, oh my God, I've been up all night. I have mud all over my
My God.
shoes. My jeans are covered on the bottom. Like I was crawling through our facilities looking for, potential problems. And first thing both of them did was give me a big bear hug, and
Oh,
that's something I'll just never forget.
yeah.
It was heartwarming.
Such a lesson in leadership, really, from my perspective, both what you did and Keith and Todd and just. And I, at the time, this is the other part of this, that story was I was home and my mom lives, just right up there near St. John's, the hospital that was destroyed. And, we got a call, hey, are you watching the Weather Channel? And we're like, no. And we turn it and just in time to see kind of that live broadcast of the aftermath. And like you said, you couldn't hear it reach anybody because all the cell towers were destroyed. And so, yeah, it took me a long time to figure out mom was okay. And she describes the her walls and windows, just that pressure change of just the whole house feeling like it was just
Gonna
shaking,
implode.
just shaking. Yeah, just that whole just and the damage. I think I was there after Memorial Day, which was not that long after. And I grew up in that area. You just couldn't recognize the city. It was the most surreal thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I think that stands out to a lot of us too. You were as I was trying to drive in from Carl Junction, which for the listeners is just like 10 miles north of Joplin, but as I was driving in, you couldn't figure out where you were because you really re your brain relies on landmarks, and
Yeah.
you don't realize how much your brain relies on those. And you couldn't figure out what streets you were on because they didn't look like they used to.
Yeah,
And
one city block looked
yeah.
like another city block, like another city block, just
Yes.
of destroyed homes and piled up cars.
Yes,
Yeah,
absolutely.
unbelievable. And I was with the Department of Mental Health. I'll never forget it because, Keith went down. He came back, I think Monday or Tuesday, sat us all down and said, kind of started the recovery efforts from how do we support Vicky? I always remember that. Like, what do we need to do? What rules do we need to suspend? What resources can we get Vicky? I remember just any kind of car rental expense, anything we could do from a state perspective, because you had there's no way to bill. There was no way to remember. I mean, there was just nothing to do. And we had to make payroll down there, all the things that you were going through. It was just, I remember Keith just saying, whatever Vicky needs, don't worry about it. Just get it down there. That was my instruction.
I am forever grateful to Keith Schaefer and to Todd Scheibel, and both of them were significant factors in the recovery of Joplin. I mean, they just really meant it when they said, whatever you need, just tell us what you need. I remember a really funny story. So I'm in the command center, and I'm like, you can imagine it's chaos, it's constant movement and people talking and people needing stuff, and you're writing stuff on big boards. You don't have computers, you don't have mostly cell phones or anything. And I'm moving from place to place, and this young community support worker, caseworker, is following me around, and it's really starting to annoy me a little bit. And I finally turned around and said, what do you need? And she said, I'm so sorry to bother you, but I can't get in my car. And so what had happened is so many cars were destroyed. I mean, even if your house didn't get destroyed, many of us lost cars. And so my caseworkers couldn't get out on the road because they didn't have cars. They were, destroyed. So DMH sent a bunch of cars.
Yeah, we should a bunch of
Fake
cars.
cars just arriving and arriving. And I said, what do you mean the key doesn't work, or the remote doesn't work? What, like, why can't you get into it? And she said, no, I can't get into it. And I'm like pulling teeth. I'm trying to get her to tell me, what do you mean the door won't open? She's like,
What?
no, I'm too short. It was a giant pickup truck. It was really high up.
Literally couldn't get into
She literally
the
could not get in this giant
I
pickup
need
truck.
another vehicle. I
I
can't
need to
be too
train
short.
someone who can get in the vehicle. It was,
Yeah, that's funny. That is
yeah,
funny.
the stuff that you have to think about.
Yeah, well, we learned a lot of really valuable lessons from that, didn't we? I mean,
We did.
I always remember the story, and this is just my ignorance, and I really want to give you credit. I remember Tim, I was either just taking over at the council or just coming on, and it was at a meeting with my role at DMH, but I remember Tim saying, as a system, we probably weren't taking it serious enough or prepared enough. And so I think I really am proud of what you did and others. Not only did you write chapters on in books and in manuals about emergency response, but since that decade plus now, we've, I think, as a system, really matured and learned a lot of lessons. And I feel like we're a little more ready now, and that's important. And you've reminded us of that send people to these things, attend these things. They're real, they matter, because
And they happen.
we shouldn't not we
Can
should
happen
learn
to
our
you.
lessons, shouldn't we?
Yeah, definitely. I think probably one of the biggest lessons learned and positive things that came out of the tornado, and there were many, many, many positive things that came out of the tornado. But one of them was state agencies realizing they weren't ready either. I mean, I openly admitted my disaster policy was worthless. It didn't help us at all. And it needed to be a lot more detailed. But even some of the SEMA agencies were like, we're just not ready. There were some real challenges with the morgue. And you have to, these are things you never thought you'd have to do after you graduated with your degree and you went into behavioral health. But when a disaster like that happens and you lose hundreds of people, then you have to deal with morgue situations. And so what we learned as a state is that the setting up of the morgue and running of the morgue is the role of the highway patrol, and they're really, really they excel at doing some of those things. But when you're dealing with the people who are, I mean, we had people bringing their deceased loved ones to the location. We had people looking for deceased loved ones. Children were lost in this tornado, and people were looking for confirmation that their loved one was found, and they were going to be able to take the next steps in grief, like burial and things like that. So, what we learned as a state is that that's probably not should not be the role of the highway patrol. That behavioral health is so strong in Missouri, and we do so many things that there's no reason we shouldn't be running the family centers where people really need that compassion and people who are trained to interact in those difficult, really difficult situations. So, we got on it, and Missouri kind of led the way for other states to create much better policies for disaster.
Yeah, you taught me a lot, and I remember too a funny story that I was like, you remember, to your exact point, the work you did, it had a certain color shirt if I remember, but they would walk around neighborhoods. Yeah, they'd walk around neighborhoods, and my brain always said that had to be some licensed counselor, it had to be a some really highly trained person, and you and others taught me. A lot of folks just need to know someone's there, tell their story, share that feeling of fear and loss, and just that anxiety, just to share that through talk with someone who's been trained a little bit. Don't get me wrong, they have some training and know how to connect resources if necessary and all that. But really, that you guys just knocked that program out, and I don't know how many miles you walked and how many bottles of water you gave out, but just making sure the community was healthy and recovering was really important, and you guys really stepped up to the plate there.
Yeah, the blue shirts are probably my number one thing I'm most proud of for this behavioral health response to our community, and also went on to become a nationally recognized team, and changed the way FEMA encourages people to create a disaster response. So I too, I'm a licensed psychologist. I too thought, oh my gosh, I need to start hiring massive numbers of therapists, people
Yeah,
licensed
yeah.
to do the job that they typically do. And what I quickly figured out from the community is they didn't really need therapy. They might have had a diagnosable condition, but we all had it. So what we really needed was a group of people who got some training, and we're just there. So we started them off. The blue shirts were all over town. They delivered water.
Yeah.
We worked with the prison system. Keith, I think, got us connected to that in Missouri, and they made us cool towels that, it was so hot here,
Yeah.
following the tornado. Very, very, very hot, very humid. People are trying to, dig through stuff, clean up. Construction workers are trying to do what they can. And these cooling towels were carried around in coolers by the blue shirts all over town with water. And you just have to figure out a way for people to instantly connect you with even a second of relief. And that second that you put that cooling towel on or take a drink of cold water when you don't have it is a connection, an instant connection.
Yeah.
I like to tell the potato, the sweet potato pie story. Can I tell it really quick?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Of course, this is great.
Excuse me. It's my favorite story. So after the tornado, moved along for several months, FEMA got trailers out, and there was one giant trailer community out north of town. And so our blue shirts were out there daily. And this one young man, very young individual, kept knocking on the trailer door of this woman who was elderly, probably late 70s, I would say, early 80s. And she just would not engage with him at all. She would close the door as soon as she saw it was him. He just could not figure out a way to connect with her. And kind of knew that it was maybe important that he connected with her. She never had anyone over there. No one was checking on her. She seemed very isolated and alone.
Oh, man.
And she lost everything. So we were, concerned, really concerned about people. And so he finally says to her, "What would put a smile on your face?" And she says, smart alecky, "A sweet potato pie," and slams the door. He goes to the grocery store. He's talking to his mom. She's telling him what he needs in terms of ingredients.
Oh, he's gonna make
He makes a sweet potato
it.
pie. I mean, it's May. They aren't out there in the stores yet. It's not Thanksgiving yet. So he makes a sweet potato pie, and he goes back the next day, and he knocks on her door, and he's standing there with the sweet potato pie, like right there. She opens the door, and instantly there's that smile. Instantly there's that connection. And make a long story short, ultimately he did discover that she was days away from taking her own life.
Oh.
She had nothing to live for. The thought of having to rebuild at her age, after having lost everything, having no support, was just overwhelming for her. And she was planning a way out. And we were able to intervene and stop that from happening, but all because of a sweet potato pie.
Yeah, that's right. I love that. Well, and it really is remarkable the work you did, and that community was suffering. The whole community did come together. I just haven't really seen much like it in my lifetime, and you know, your leadership was incredibly valuable for that, and your team. And you know, we lost a lot of lives. The system lost lives. We had several DMH clients and some agency staff. On the DD side, I know that lost their life. Some state folks got hurt, injured. I know you guys had within your own agencies people impacted directly. So it was a terrible tragedy. But like you said, we've learned a lot, and you guys really helped that community heal. So I just wanted to get that on the podcast because it's such an amazing stories that came out of that dark tragedy back in May of 21. Can you believe it was that long ago, Vicky?
It is sometimes amazing to think that that many years has gone by, that you're talking 14 years ago now.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And
That's
it's
amazing.
a major part of our history. It's a major part of who we are now. It shaped us again. Even adults, it shaped us. It's a different community, and you can't always stop those things from happening. You can get better prepared, though.
That's
And
right. That's right.
so we spend a lot of time talking about preparedness, and I preached it across the state and
Yeah.
national.
Yeah, you have definitely been a giving of those lessons, and they are important ones for sure. And like you said, it really did kind of change the physical, not just who Ozark Center was, but then it really did change the physical appearance of what Ozark Center was in really amazing ways. And we'll get into one of them, because you took that opportunity as you had to rebuild to kind of really do some cool trauma informed stuff. But before we like hop into that, I want to kind of segue a little bit to that what I talked about in your intro, and that is how Ozark Center and Vicky and you and your team have kind of led the way on a lot of pretty really innovative and kind of things that today were like kind of a part of what a CCBHC is in the state, like literally written into the requirements of what it is to be one of those entities that we've now kind of promoted nationally. But you know, you started Ozark Center, not always alone, but with a few others. But you know, Ozark Center was always there, kind of the start of some of those really cool, innovative things. And then, like I said in the beginning, then get replicated not only in Missouri, but then nationally in many ways. So I want to give you a ton of credit for that and give you an opportunity, if it's okay, just to kind of spend a few minutes to talk about these really cool things that you guys kind of brought up. And I kind of, the first on my list was one that we became aware of kind of right as I was starting, and that was that Zero Suicide Initiative. Can you kind of talk about how that came to be and how, I guess, your attention, you bought into that so quickly. Like how did that happen?
So, interestingly enough, Ozark Center's 60th anniversary or birthday
Yeah.
is February 15th, 1965, is when we were created and founded. So, our 60th birthday is this month, and I've been doing a lot of prep for some, TV spots and a banquet and some other things, and speaking at different public things. And so, I've been going backwards, and looking at our last 60 years, and interestingly enough, I've been here 41 of those. So I've been a part of
Yeah.
a portion of what we've been able to accomplish. But Zero Suicide was a 2012 initiative by the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention, supported by SAMHSA. It was critical to us, because we were coming off that disaster, a year, less than a year before, and it was really important to stay on top of what was happening with our children. So it was very child focused for us. And one of the interesting things about the Zero Suicide Initiative is it kind of dovetailed with another initiative that came out of it, and that was our frustration with the school system not being able to allow us to go on site and do therapy or case management or anything else because of some Medicaid billing rules. So we pushed and pushed and pushed out of the Zero Suicide Initiative to, one of the key factors of the Zero Suicide Initiative is leadership driven. Get in there and figure out ways that you can create a safe culture. So out of that key factor, we pushed and pushed and pushed and got approved to do a pilot project in McDonald County in their school system. And that was the very first time that legitimately behavioral health therapists and case managers were assigned inside of a school, and that was their assigned location. And we were able to do a lot of initiatives under the Zero Suicide Project. That pilot project went on for a couple of years. We collected data. There was concern that if this rule was changed, we would, it would cost the state significant general revenue dollars. So we kept pushing and saying, no, it won't. It's just serving kids where they are. It likely could reduce the number of dollars being spent on these kids, because the kids aren't getting what they need and they keep readmitting. And maybe we can stop that if we give them, what they need, where they need it. And the school system was phenomenal in McDonald County because they understood that, kids are for healthy kids. We want them involved in extracurricular activities. We want them having dinner at home. We want them interacting with family. When do you fit therapy in there? When do you fit
Yeah, right.
services in there? So we have to do it where we have them. Also, it's really hard on the family to drive, take off work and drive them to services. So this pilot project went on for 2 years. We collected a lot of data. We pushed and pushed and pushed with MoHealthNet, and everyone agreed this would work. And it finally passed. And now everybody has, across the state, there are tons of really great services happening in the schools. And really, I think it came out of that Zero Suicide Initiative.
Wow.
Yeah, and
So
it
you can
worked.
almost draw a line between that Zero Suicide Initiative starting post-tornado, really worried about youth and impact of that on your communities, into understanding the need in schools, to now our services in schools have exploded because of that. I mean, it really has a big factor of swimming upstream in care, hasn't it? That's pretty
Super proud of
amazing.
this initiative because it was a major change in philosophy, in how billing occurs. There were lots of people who had to get on board with this. But, we still to this day do a lot of suicide training in all the schools, all came out of that suicide initiative. And it works because I'm getting ready for the 60th anniversary
Right.
and collecting a lot of data. And I learned that in the last 5 years, there's been only three suicides of students. Now I say only, with a hitch in my heart because I don't want to lose any children to suicide. But the last 3 years have been zero suicides. So it takes sometimes it takes a while. It's been 13 years, but sometimes it takes a while to build it all.
Yeah,
But it works. It's
that's
ha
awesome.
happening. We're getting good results. So I'm really pleased about that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I know we could talk 30 minutes to an hour on all these, but I don't want to shortchange you on the several initiatives that I just am personally aware of, and I know there are others I'm probably not aware of. But the other one, I just love how you helped us get started on kind of. I mentioned it as it related to kind of your rebuilding after the tornadoes, but trauma was something that you were an early leader on, along with a few others, but just kind of the impact of trauma on our patients' lives, on our staff, on our lives, kind of how we deal with it or don't deal with it, how it can impact our overall health. And you were a big leader in kind of trying to educate and learn and teach about trauma. And then maybe how we could both, conduct better treatment while we recognize that, but design better spaces that handle trauma differently. So again, just I know you love this one too, but like how do you get drawn to that, and kind of can you touch on how that transformed Ozark Center and your culture?
Yeah, this one is also really near and dear to my heart. And this one, I didn't expect this turnaround. So in 2009, 2 years prior to that devastating tornado in 2011, we started as an early adopter for trauma-informed care. It was challenging and difficult. I mean, today, trauma-informed care is the expectation, not the exception. But back then, that was not the case. And so we had to learn a lot. We went to a lot of trainings. We spent a lot of hours working on trauma-informed care. One of the principles of trauma-informed care is safety and trustworthiness. Those are two principles. So in terms of getting us ready from a safety perspective, it would be one thing for us to evaluate our safety and our facilities and how our clients feel, but it's another thing to ask them. So we put together a bunch of groups of clients that were regulars for us, and we knew they had many people seeking behavioral health services have a trauma background that you may or may not even know about. We didn't even ask until 2009. You just assume. But we asked them, like, if you look around this building, what are the things that bother you, that affect you, that might trigger your trauma? And we learned things we never expected, one of which is it's very triggering for a patient or client to walk into a healthcare provider area, whether it's behavioral health or medical, and see these rooms that are built out for your reception staff and these sliding glass windows that people talk to you through. Now, the client, I mean, we're saying, but that's protecting your confidentiality. That's a way that we're addressing HIPAA. That's not how they see it. What they see is this waiting room is so dangerous that you have to protect your number one resource, which is your staff, behind walls. And they can only talk through a small sliding glass window because it's so dangerous out here, which is not the case at all. But that's the message they get. They also get messages from a lot of locked doors. We used to have, in mental health, we used to have locked doors everywhere. You have a key to go further down the hall. The locked doors mean to somebody with trauma that they can't get out. If they need to get out, they need to be free to move fast. Also, signage was a big deal. If you have to stop and read signage, you're vulnerable to what's behind you. So when we had the opportunity to redo all of our buildings, which we didn't ask for, but we got that opportunity.
Had to.
We worked with an architect who went and studied kind of people moving techniques. And so a lot of our buildings are built and designed with things in the floor, the flooring changes, the ceiling changes, and automatically your brain just knows where you're supposed to go. And very little signage. There are no sliding glass door. All of our reception areas, admission areas are completely open. We had to learn a lot about how to still be confidential. But you want to be welcoming. You want people to feel like it's a good place to be. It's not welcoming when you walk into a waiting room and you're only allowed to speak when the window's open.
It doesn't feel
That's
very,
a feeling. Yeah. So all of our
I always
buildings have.
remember, Vicki, when you talk about this, I always remember this one dumb story that stuck in my brain where I somehow got on some travel I was doing in a pretty bad part of a town, and the little train thing had the plastic, the bars, and there's this little bitty hole, and I'm like, I need a ticket to, and you're like, I know I'm not safe. And so we kind of had a lot of things in our system that
And
triggered
we didn't intend to send that message,
but
any
it
of
just
us.
was, yeah.
And people who still have those options today don't intend to send that message. But it was interesting to learn from the people you're serving, what that message was, how it was being received.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things we did is we hired a photographer in every facility that we have in the four counties. We have the photographer go out and take pick iconic pictures. So things that if you grew up in Neosho or you grew up in Lamar, or you grew up in Joplin, you instantly recognize from your childhood.
Yeah.
And so those are in all of our buildings now. And it's really fascinating to watch people connect with those pictures. It gives them a moment of maybe a better time, a reminder that things haven't always been this bad. So there's a lot of things you can do in a building to make people who have a traumatic history feel more welcomed, more safe, and ultimately they trust you more.
Yeah. Well, and you were an early adopter in that trauma approach, and then I've watched it grow to, like I said, to now we have a full trauma learning collaborative group that, and we have a company that is working on that all the time, and it's bled over into children's division, and they're trying to kind of get more trauma training. It really, again, just appreciate Vicki so much, you and your team kind of taking on those tough early adopter efforts, and then kind of once again seeing it grow and then get over into the national side. And you know, that's one of the things that we talk about in Missouri CCBHC approach is that that's, like you said, that's the standard now. And that wasn't always the case just not that long ago. So just
It was
another
not,
example.
and it's not talked about a lot. And we were completely surprised and honored when the National Council awarded us the Award of Excellence for our efforts in the building, mostly as it
Yeah,
relates to trauma-informed care. That was
super.
very, very,
What a
very
cool honor. That was a
cool for us.
neat
Yeah,
honor for
very
sure.
cool. Yeah.
Yeah, congratulations. And then another one that I love because you like to show it off, that transcranial magnetic stimulation, just a real cutting edge technology. And you know, again, you brought that down there, and now, I mean, we've everywhere I go now, Vicki, whether it's I just did St. Louis and Independence Center and ARCA, and that one of the things they're really proud of is look at this TMS machine we got, and we just started our first patient, or we now have three patients, and the one just graduated and he's just doing incredibly well. So, I mean, it is really cool. I mean, we're not going to impact, you know, tens of thousands of people, but the hundreds of people that will get impacted by this every single year that will grow into the thousands. It's a substantial difference in their lives. And what were you somewhere? Did someone talk to you? Like, how did that even get down there? Because you were the
Yeah.
first.
So, one of the things that drives me and why I am so focused on innovation at Ozark Center is kind of my thing. Is I'm my goal is to make sure that my community, the citizens around me in my four counties, are not having to drive to Springfield, Tulsa, Kansas City, or Little Rock to get whatever it is they need. And
Right.
living in this four state area, that's what happens in healthcare. When you can't get what you need, you know, we always have to drive somewhere else, and it's not okay. And for behavioral health, which I can control a little bit, I don't want that to happen. So one of my psychiatrists came to me and said, "Yeah, I really, really, really want us to do transcranial magnetic stimulation." I'm like, "What is it? I don't even know what
Yeah,
it is."
totally.
So I learned about it, did a lot of research. We picked the company that we preferred, which was NeuroStar. Had them come down, and I spent a lot of time looking at the research. This is a major game changer for people with major depressive disorder who are not responding to typical treatment. And this is a small number of people. The percentage of people who have major depressive disorder is small, but we're spending the most money on that small percentage of people. And so we started seeing significant change, you know, upwards to 75% of the people who are coming through are having major change in their depression. So because I do feel like I am responsible for the state as well as for Joplin sometimes. I mean, like, I want to share it. It's like, you guys should
Yeah.
do this. And the funny thing is that when I called Neurostar about this, they were like, we haven't dealt with people who aren't private practitioners.
That's
So
right.
there was a couple of them in St. Louis and Kansas City that were private offices that were doing this. And I'm like, so what? Like, why can't we can have it too? I ask them, is Medicaid paid for it? And they're like, oh no, we have never talked about doing that.
That's right.
So, you know me, I'm on a mission now. I'm gonna make sure that Missouri has this option in our community behavioral health system, and Medicaid should pay for it because it is a money saver. And that's what the state has to think like about,
Yeah.
and so we did another pilot and showed the significant difference in cost for these small number of patients, but still they were spending a lot of money on them. They're oftentimes hospitalized in psych units multiple times a year. They're often having to go through a lot of different meds and trashing their meds and starting over. And it's a lot of money wasted on meds because nothing's working for them. So why not give them an option? So we now have three chairs. We like
Do you
another one.
really?
Yeah, we do. We have chairs.
So you're up to three now. Wow, that's
Yeah. And fun thing is, I don't even know if you know this, but we've started a new project. We don't have a cool name for it yet, but it's psychiatric interventionalist program. And so we're moving all the procedural things, the cool procedural things that psych finally got and didn't have for many, many, many hundreds of years. Now we have cool procedural things, and we feel like we did some data analysis, and we feel like not enough people are coming for the procedures that should. And so we're going to highlight it, put it in a separate building. We're going to highlight transcranial magnetic stimulation. We're going to highlight Spravato, which is also a major game changer for people with major depressive disorder that's not responding to treatment. We're going to highlight some of the new long-term injectables. We're going to highlight eventually the use of psychedelics, MDMA, when those get FDA approved. And so this is a fun opportunity. Our psychiatrists are thrilled. We're
That's
taking
super
it into
cool.
the hospital and doing an inpatient version and an outpatient version. Should be up and running in the fall. But there's too many people not getting a treatment that has very little side effects,
Yeah.
very few.
Well, I really want, there's like two things come to mind there, Vicki. One is we do this work and you talk to Medicaid, we arrange it, we send them data, we send them, all that. Our good friend over there, Eric Martin, is a great advocate and he works through, but people don't understand how tough it is to, it's like turning a cruise ship, it's not like a little boat on the lake. It's like turning, you gotta really takes a lot of work to get stuff added to Medicaid and figured out in Medicaid. But yeah, we think about, I don't know how many states. I know a few had gotten it in Medicaid or at least were in the process, if I recall, but I don't know of many states that kind of brought it up within their entire state safety net system, based on data that some early, like Ozark Center adopted that, innovated that. And then all of a sudden now from rural North Missouri down to Southeast Missouri, we have these chairs that, like you said, now folks in those local communities that need it can access it. And that's pretty neat. That's pretty cool.
You
And
know, Brent, you were right there with me. You and Eric Martin was,
yeah.
key factor. It was challenging. It's challenging to move the system. It's always challenging. But, this was critical. People, Medicare paid for it, private insurance paid for it. They saw the back-end benefit.
That's right. Those privates, markets and others did. And we got them there. And then how cool is it that I think in a way, the way you're positioning it, and I know there's it, like you said, you're kind of highlighting it and bringing those interventions in a kind of a marketed a line of service and a new focus building and all that. What a cool idea. So, that's not the way a normal safety net center works. It's not the way we've been, and a lot of that has to do with CCBHC and other innovative ways Missouri's positioned financing, which is not perfect. We need more. We know that. But in other ways, it's allowed us to do a few things. And what a to have a CCBHC, a safety net provider in a community, think like that and market like that is really, that's not common. And so that's really cool, Vicki. I love that.
Thank you. We're excited about it.
Well, we're getting close to time. I still got a lot, though, I want to talk to you about. We just don't have the time to do it. But one of the things I got to get this story in, Vicki. So we had the whole CCBHC thing, and they wanted the HHS wanted to do a tour, and they had a bunch of folks from the Office of the Secretary come, and Dorn and I were having to pick, kind of where to go, and they were flying into and doing a few other things. And so we ended up going through Springfield over to Joplin and toured your several things. We toured, and they just want to know what does a CCBHC look like. So we went to Carl Junction Schools, I remember. We had a great presentation at your office at the new Hope Center, which is another tornado story. That really you consolidated into the old highway department building, if I recall. And anyways, redid that whole building in that trauma-informed approach. And then we did the MAT clinic downtown Joplin, if I remember. And we got to talking about peers. And I'll never forget this because you told those folks that you said, I'll never forget, you're like, I was not an early adopter on the peer services. Just had some reluctance around some of the things that you got to work through with that. And there are always and will always be some issues there that you got to be careful around. But I remember you saying that, now I can't imagine running some programs without peers, and you've got the great veterans program that is doing outreach to veterans. And I know your father was a veteran. You have a lot of ties to that community. And the lady, I'll never forget, the MAT clinic, the director was like, I run it by title. She runs the program by action. And it was a peer. And just all these things that I was like, what a cool, I just remember those federal folks being so impressed by that and jotting notes, and they wanted to talk to Dorn more about that. But that has been transformative down there, and I love your veteran program. I love that MAT clinic and how you've really integrated peers into your system too.
Yeah, our experience with peers was incredibly negative. We tried. We had difficulty hiring. We had difficulty with the usual things you would expect with peers, crossing boundaries and safety and risk is a big thing for me, and it just seemed like it was a major risk to our clients, and so I didn't push my staff. And then in what was it, 2017, we went the CCBHC
That's right.
route.
Yeah, right.
I gotta figure this out
Yeah.
because it's a requirement. So I sat my staff down and said, let's think about it from a different perspective. Let's start with programs that might make more sense to us. And one of those was the Veteran Integration Program, which was also another item as a CCBHC that, we had to be able to demonstrate our veterans initiative. So to combine the two things, I thought, well, veterans are very difficult population. It's like law enforcement and first responders. They're supposed to be tough. They're not supposed to, they don't feel comfortable admitting their weaknesses and they're not coming. So how do we get them to come? And so I just came up with this idea that I'm going to hire some veterans and then I'm going to train them to be peers.
Hire. Yeah, we're just
Yeah,
gonna
I'm going to
hire
hire
the veteran.
veterans because these two guys that started the program, one is still with us, Roger Koch, they're just veterans. They have no background in behavioral health. And I took a weird approach to it, and I said, I don't care if we can bill it or not. Let's just have these guys go out and drink coffee and go to everything that's designed for veterans, where veterans might hang out, any kind of social event, set up booths where we can, where we might connect with a veteran, and we'll just do it that way. And then probably after the first year, we got them trained as peer specialists, and we were able to get some revenue back on their services. But I mean, since they started, we're now close to 3,000 veterans we've treated.
It's
And
amazing.
it's amazing. Like, probably started about 2018, 2019. So, they're bringing them in the door, and it's super cool to, and I think I can officially say this now, Roger's story was submitted by one of our employees to the, as the mental health champion applicant, and now been chosen as the 2025 mental illness mental health champion.
No
We will
way.
be celebrating him in May up
That
there.
is so cool. That is so cool. I think
Very cool. He works
they
very hard.
announced how, think about that connection with Roy Blunt. I think by the time this airs, it'll all be public, Vicky, so it's fine. But
That's true.
yeah, it'll be really cool that really that CCBHC effort and Senator Blunt's demand that veterans be a part of that model and how that is all getting recognized in the same year as really neat
Yes,
serendipity or whatever
which
that would
was near and dear to
describe
my heart. I was super
it.
excited about the veterans. So, it's like everything else in your world. You take something you're super excited about, and you try to create a better option for the one thing that you weren't excited about. And it worked for us in that regard. And there's a cool story that I just learned. So our housekeeping, we have our own housekeeping staff and our own transportation staff. And a gentleman had applied for one of those openings, and he accidentally went to Hope Spring to because he thought the interview was there, but it wasn't. But our staff kind of figured out something's going on with him. So they knew he was a veteran because he was wearing a hat that identified him. So they get Roger, and Roger starts talking to him. Ultimately, he's going to VA. He gets a diagnosis of PTSD. He's put on medication. His life has changed, and he's gotten a job with us. This is how Roger works. This is how the VIP program works. You just got to talk to people.
Relationship.
It's easier to get them to cross the threshold of our buildings if you walk inside beside them. I
Now
mean,
that's
that's
so
what they
cool.
do. That's what they do. So it is a cool program, and I'm really proud of them. And
As you should be. Well,
it's
Vicky, we've kept
like
you we've kept you way too long. We've gone well over our time, which I love because there's just so much to talk about. I didn't even get to some other things that you've done around AI and different innovations that are helping our staff and just different things that you've worked on from different Mo Health Net groups and other ways you've impacted our system and just can't thank you enough for your leadership, Vicki, your mentorship, having such a strong example from my home area to kind of go back to and visit, and just so proud of what Ozark Center stands for and what you've done. And just congratulations, Vicki. It's been a pleasure to have you on the Show Me State of Mind podcast today. And again, thanks for all you do.
thanks, Brent. I'm so glad our relationship has expanded over the years.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks again for joining us and appreciate our listeners. Listen, this has been an amazing lesson of our system. So thank you, Vicki, and
You're welcome.
appreciate it.